supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. After Tiffany Valiante was struck and killed by a New Jersey transit train 2 years ago, investigators ruled that she committed suicide. Her family, though, never believed that Tiffany would kill herself. They always suspected the 18-year-old volleyball star fell victim to foul play, and now they're taking their case to court, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
In the yard next to their Mays Landing home in Atlantic County, the Valiante family has a constant reminder of the daughter they lost 2 years ago, a regulation-size volleyball court.
My husband built this for Tiffany. He promised her when she came back from Mercy College the first year that she'd be able to play all summer, play volleyball, bring all her friends out here and stuff. So he made that promise and kept it. And he built this afterwards, but
I don't think I would have built it that big, but I went full regulation. I mean,
Tiffany was headed to college to play, but she never got the chance. On July 12, 2015, she was struck and killed by a New Jersey transit train a few miles from her home. Investigators said she killed herself, but right away, her mother, Diane, had doubts.
When they first came to the house to tell us, I made them repeat themselves because I just was in shock. I'm like, it's not my Tiffany, you know?
For one, the family found Tiffany's phone on the ground after she disappeared, but they said she was basically attached to her phone, so much so that she bought a waterproof case to be able to bring it into the shower. Also, it was nighttime when Tiffany disappeared, and she was afraid of the dark. But most of all, Tiffany was happy, her family said. She had promise. Her mother, Diane, says that never seemed to matter to investigators.
How come nobody's questioned us? I can't understand. Nobody's been to my home. I just don't understand.
Tiffany's shoes were found far from where she died, but to get to the spot where the train hit her, she'd have had to walk over rocks and dirty ground, yet her feet were clean and undamaged in the autopsy photos. That's one of the many criticisms attorney Paul D'Amato has of the investigation into her death.
What is in that file of the state medical examiner's office that led them to rush to judgment to conclude that it was suicide? And that is quite disturbing. Because just think about it for a second. You have parents, you have sisters that have to live with the fact that some governmental agency concluded that their loved one committed suicide.
This week, D'Amato filed a civil lawsuit in state court asking a judge to change the medical examiner's ruling from suicide to undetermined. The attorney general's office, which oversees the state medical examiner, declined to comment. New Jersey Transit didn't return messages. The suit is also asking for a jury trial to explore the family's belief that Tiffany was murdered.
Somehow she was there, and I think somebody grabbed her, assaulted her, and eventually took her to that particular area by way of the White Horse Pike. That's what I think.
Tiffany squabbled with a friend and her mother over a credit card bill that night, but her mom said it wasn't a big fight, definitely not significant enough to lead to suicide. And family members aren't the only ones who still believe Tiffany didn't kill herself.
I don't feel from the kid I knew that that's even possible.
Allison Walker is the head women's volleyball coach at Stockton University. She also runs a junior travel team, which Tiffany played on. Walker has coached a lot of young women and says Tiffany never struck her as suicidal.
Very affectionate, always the one hugging everybody and, you know, jumping on their back and bringing the team together. I still could never envision that. It's just not the Tiffany I knew.
From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The commission appointed by President Donald Trump to investigate election fraud held its first meeting today after many states rejected its request for detailed data on voters. WHYY's Dave Davies has a look at just what information about voters is available from public records and what people are doing with that information.
The President's Commission asked states for detailed information on voters, including the last four digits of their Social Security numbers, and said it would make the information public. Most states have refused, citing privacy concerns. The commission invited citizen comment and got plenty of emails, which it published on its website. A few are supportive, like this one.
This is a necessary investigation. A lot of ineligible people voted in the last presidential election.
But most are critical, even mocking. Here's a sampling.
Hi, I voted in all 50 states. Just wanted you to know.
Does the term secret ballot mean anything to you? Nobody is fooled. You're out to suppress liberal-leaning voters.
Aren't you fools tired of trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist?
You are all about voter suppression to rig elections. You are evil.
Go f*** yourself.
When Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf wrote the commission rejecting its request, he noted that the commission, or anyone, can purchase the state's voter file for $20. I decided to see just how easy it is to get the file and use it. A visit to the state's website with my credit card got me a download in minutes. There's a lot of information about the state's 8 million voters. Not Social Security numbers, but addresses, birth dates, every change of party, and every election voted in since 2006, even some home phone numbers. But if you think you can download the file and start looking up names, think again. The first thing you discover is that the voter file is actually 268 separate files, four for each of the state's 67 counties. They're text files, so you have to convert the information to some spreadsheet software like Excel, and you can only do one county at a time.
When you download all that information, it is sort of clumsy to work with.
That's Al Schmidt, co-chair of the Philadelphia Office of City Commissioners, which oversees elections. With time, effort, and a little help from colleagues, I managed to get a workable file of Philadelphia's 1 million registered voters. That's the material Schmidt and his staff work with to extract insights into voting.
We dig into that data to try to get a closer look at voter behavior. Did a large number of center city millennial voters show up that don't normally show up in a municipal election? And that happened this last time around.
Schmidt says the city and state do have partial Social Security and driver's license numbers in their databases. They're never released to the public, but he says they help distinguish people who may have the same name, if there's a question of duplicate registration, for example. Schmidt also uses that information to investigate vote fraud and tampering. His office has referred 9 cases for prosecution in the past several years and gotten 8 guilty pleas. He says there are few cases, and they always involve small numbers of votes.
When we've seen it, we're talking about races that are very local and can be determined or influenced by handfuls of votes.
Asked what he thinks of President Trump's claim that 3 million people voted illegally last year, Schmidt, a Republican, says,
that would be an astonishing number. I'd be interested in seeing where that number comes from, what basis in fact it's grounded in.
The people who really work public voter files are political professionals. Democratic strategist Mark Nevin subscribes to a service called Catalyst that takes voter rolls and integrates them with other information on race, religion, union affiliation, even consumer habits.
They've taken this data and they've profiled the people who are likely to fit one category or another. Are they likely to be, for example, a pro-choice voter? Are they likely to support, healthcare reform? Are they likely to support gun safety legislation?
So there's a lot of information out there about most of us that we can't take back. But the Pennsylvania Department of State reports it's now getting calls from voters saying they want to cancel their registration. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Lead paint is bad for children. In fact, it's the way most kids get lead poisoning. But lead is everywhere, including in drinking water. Some worry that street construction can make that problem worse. State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo reports that most parents know very little about how lead gets into tap water.
On the 3,000 block of Rosehill Street in North Philadelphia, the water mains are being replaced. It's routine maintenance. What's not routine is replacing the lead pipes that bring water from the main into each house. Manuel Ortiz lives on the block, in a two-story, three-bedroom row house.
My wife and my sons, they drink a lot of water, me too.
He doesn't know if he has lead pipes, so we go down to his basement to find out. we scratch the pipe coming from the street with a coin and place a magnet to see if it sticks. Does it stick?
They don't stick.
It looks like you have a lead service line.
Yeah. So that's good or that's bad?
That's bad.
That's bad? Oh my God.
It's bad because lead pipes mean lead could be leaching into his water. This is really bad news for Ortiz. His son already has brain damage caused by lead poisoning. Their old apartment had lead paint. And although Manuel Jr. is 13, his father says he acts like a 10-year-old.
I feel sad because, you know, but we still, like, gotta deal with it. I mean, we gotta help him. I mean, we're a low-income family, so a lot of people go through it.
Ortiz moved into this house because he thought it was safer for his kid. But he didn't know it was one of an estimated 60,000 houses that still have lead service lines in Philadelphia. Since lead pipes were banned in 1986, all houses built after that are technically safe. Now, here's where things could get even worse for Ortiz. That construction outside on the street could be agitating his pipes, breaking off pieces of lead into his water. Yana Lambrinidu is a researcher from Virginia Tech. She says even a heavy truck passing by your street could release lead from the pipes.
These physical disturbances can, in fact, weaken the protective layers inside pipes, even potentially for years after the physical disturbance.
The Philadelphia Water Department says its pipes have protective layers that prevent leaching caused by most construction work or heavy trucks. But large jobs like replacing a water main do put people like Manuel Ortiz and his family at risk. Here's how Water Department researcher Gary Burlingame says residents should protect themselves.
Go to the cold water tap that's closest to the water meter and run it as full force as you can without flooding your basement for like 30 minutes.
Yes, 30 minutes at full force. And you should do this every time there's construction on your block, every 2 weeks, for 3 months. That's so much water. In fact, the department says everyone in every house in Philadelphia should run their cold water tap for 3 to 5 minutes each morning. I did that today, and it was enough to fill half of my bathtub. But the point is, if your water sits more than 6 hours in lead pipes, you could be drinking that lead. This is news for Ortiz.
So you gotta flush the water for 5 minutes? Okay. So I ain't know that.
He's not alone. Maurice Sampson from the environmental group Clean Water Action says people get poisoned due to a lack of information.
The truth is, if you know where the lead is, you can protect yourself.
Sampson says the city should do more to tell people about the connection between street construction and lead in their tap water.
There should be an obligation to inform everybody, and there should be a procedure you go through, which starts with, while that's going on, you should be drinking bottled water.
Another way to avoid lead is to use lead-certified water filters. Experts say cities with older houses like Philadelphia should offer them for free. That's what Pittsburgh did. Philadelphia is trying to get rid of lead pipes. To do that, it offers lead pipe replacements at no cost when they're replacing the water mains. And that can save homeowners from $3,000 to $8,000. But State Impact spoke to about 40 residents in both North and South Philadelphia. Only a few remember the Water Department notification that explains this program and how to flush taps. Ortiz says he never saw it.
No. No letters from the Water Department. The only letters that come is bills.
And even if he did get the letter, which is only in English, the final decision is not up to him. He would have to convince his landlord. For now, he says he will flush his water. Catalina Jaramillo, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Despite overwhelming obstacles, Philadelphia high school student Savannah Zayas persevered, earned her diploma, and is now infusing her grade school daughter with the same can-do attitude. She's profiled in season 1 of the new Keystone Crossroads podcast, Schooled. Episode 1 premieres today, and I have the pleasure of speaking with the podcast host, Keystone Crossroads reporter Kevin McCrory. Kevin, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
What was the idea behind Schooled?
I write about public education, policy, and political detail a lot, and I wanted to be able to tell more of the story of the people who are really affected by those issues. So students, the families, and get points of view from teachers and educators.
How did you come to Savannah?
So Savannah testified at a city council hearing, and I was struck by her maturity. This was clearly someone who had lived a very tough life, had seen things go right, go wrong in schools. And not only did she have that experience, but she could put words to it and really was adept at telling her own story. I talked to a lot of kids, a lot of students across the state, across Philadelphia. They're not always as able to put their thoughts and feelings into words.
So in turn, let's let listeners in on that clip.
So what you're about to hear right now is from episode 2 of the podcast, where Savannah is testifying before city council. And this was a period where the school district had just outsourced its staffing service. And it was a disaster across much of the city. And it really hit Savannah hard. And you'll hear that in her testimony.
I used to know my source of support. Her name was Ms. Woodward. She motivated me to keep striving, even though the moments... This is very emotional. Even though the moments sometimes got hard.
Savannah actually testified about this at a Philadelphia City Council hearing last year. She was there to talk about the problems caused by teacher vacancies at Edison. After Woodward left, the class was overseen by a revolving door of fill-ins and long-term substitutes.
I feel lost. And I feel unmotivated. My grades, which have been very high, reflected that too. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Savannah. I go to school to learn. And I would, like, when she left, I just felt like I was going to school and it was just a waste of my time. Like, it was really, like, I was going to school every day frustrated. I used to snap, like, all my friends. I used to tell us, like, what are we doing? Like, don't you see that we just wasting time coming to this classroom every day, not doing anything, not preparing us for SAT, not preparing us for college, we're just doing nothing.
Turnover also makes the job even harder for the educators who remain. Again, Sydney Coffin.
It was very frustrating. I took in a lot of the kids from her class, so I would have 60 kids sometimes in my room because they just didn't have a teacher. And then the teacher they got who filled in after her teacher had left was really incompetent.
Then that replacement teacher left.
There was nobody in there for them, like emotionally, even physically, for a period of time, and long enough that the kids were just wandering the halls.
Kevin, did you in turn have the opportunity to speak with Mrs. Woodward?
I did. I reached out to Mrs. Woodward. I tracked her down. She is a teacher at Alani Charter High School, which is really the next neighborhood over from Edison, where Savannah attended. It was at a point in the year where Savannah was feeling very, very low. And I actually invited Savannah to come along with us, and I was really glad I did because they had a great moment together and it seemed to really pick Savannah's spirit up. But Woodward spoke to this idea, I think that is a theme in the podcast, that, you know, so many kids in these schools don't have people that they can really rely on in their personal life. And
Savannah certainly falls into that category and convey a sense of what the obstacles were for her outside of school.
Savannah is a victim of sexual abuse as a child. She has lived a very difficult, contentious home life with her mother. She's often been kind of a second mom to her younger siblings. You know, she was pregnant at age 14, a mom at 15. Her mom also was a teen mother. She had Savannah at age 16. She talks in the podcast about, you know, not wanting that pregnancy at first, actively trying to terminate it by using PCP. There's a lot there, and she's lived a very tough life that way.
It's overwhelming that she had such an inner drive. It's so easy to succumb to all of the environmental factors that have done in so many before her.
Part of it is there was a period of time where she lived in Lower Bucks County after she was abused. You know, the period from like age 6 through age 11 or 12, she, I think, saw a different world that helped her understand that there's something else to get to. So that when she's dropped back in Kensington and she's, you know, living in a house facing McPherson Square in Kensington, which is called Needle Park, and she sees drug addicts and violence, horrific things all around her. She has this image in her head of, you know what, this isn't the only way it can be, that there is something else out there. The same thing with school. She's been in schools that are well-resourced and well-run. So then when she's in an environment where she doesn't feel like it's ideal, she can really vividly understand and see the disparity. And that makes her, I think, a leader, because then she's advocating for something to be changed for the better.
Kevin, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Kevin McCrory, education reporter for Keystone Crossroads. The podcast School premieres today. A new comic book hit the shelves today, depicting a global calamity that leaves teenagers with special powers. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the comic's main superhero is a kid with Down syndrome.
So out in space, there's this mysterious meteor. It has certain unidentified properties, and it collides with the Earth. It breaks up in the atmosphere, splits apart, and pieces of it slam into towns around the world.
The meteors hit Earth. And when teenagers come in contact with these meteor fragments, they become enhanced. They get various superpowers.
That is Sheena Howard, a professor at Rider University. She was in a comic shop on Philadelphia's South Street signing copies of her new comic book she co-authored, Superb. In the story, a teenager with Down syndrome comes into contact with the meteor. He develops the ability to temporarily mute and paralyze people with rays that shoot out of his eyes.
So in the first issue, you see him getting teased on the school bus. And so actually, I wanted to make one of his powers to silence people, because I'm thinking, as a kid who gets teased, one of the things that you want to do is, like, shut people up sometimes, right? Stop them in their tracks.
You don't see a lot of superheroes with learning disabilities. Superb is published by a company called Catalyst Prime, which created a superhero universe designed to be diverse and inclusive. For example, the co-star of Superb is a black teenage girl who develops super strength. For her day job, Howard writes a lot about race and sexual orientation in American culture. Her comic book writing is meant primarily to entertain, but real-life issues creep into this story, set in a Rust Belt town in Ohio after a cataclysmic disaster.
Really, the story is trying to show how this town picks up the pieces after this 9/11 type event. So eventually we're going to get into storylines around how people use the media in different and nefarious ways, start creating fake news stories. So we touch on subtly some real life things.
Howard says right now about 9 issues of Superb are in the pipeline, and if the audience wants it, she's willing to write it indefinitely. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Let's turn the page on tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.